Hello, welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm talking to Irving Welsh about his novel Trainspotting. It's always, this is a confession, a fascinating thing when I come into the book club, which we've been going for 2 or 3 years now, because you just want to see the writer, but I want to see you see, because we always wonder, what do the readers of Doris Lessing or Margaret Atwood or Irving Welsh look like? Because it's always really different, you see. And you all think you're completely normal, but you're all different from the author. Believe me, you're different from Edna O'Brien. And with you, Irving, there's a special kind of ignoble interest for me, because I looked up, there's a British Council encyclopedia of leading contemporary British novelists, and it says about Irving that he is the only person in this encyclopedia who reaches beyond the influence of the bourgeois novel. So that's that gave nice. Me a special frisson for this evening. It also says you're carnivalesque and you produce unforgettably graphic acts of bodily expulsion.
I won't do that just now, though. You know,
in your novels. Yeah. And I think that was meant as quite a critical compliment, actually.
Right.
Well, I wanted to start with a question which has a sort of, I mean, it's a bit of a personal reason for asking this, because I wanted to start by asking about the title, you see, because despite the fact that you reach beyond the influence of the bourgeois novel, I'm afraid I've had students writing essays about Trainspotting, which is nothing more bourgeois than that. And one student who wrote an essay we were talking about in tutorials said to me, why is it called Trainspotting? And I mean, she's a diligent student. She'd read the whole novel. She read the Trainspotting in Leith section of it. And I kind of came up with an answer, which was kind of just extemporized, but said as if it was authoritative. So I wanted to check.
What was your answer?
Yeah, right.
Well, it was going to be uncannily close to whatever it was you were just about to say. All right, shall I tell you? I said I thought it was something to do with the fact that clearly Leith didn't have a working station, and I might have said, and this was a bogus thing to say, I might have said, and it hasn't had a train for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And so Trainspotting is a kind of sardonic or ironical kind of title, which refers to the sort of the empty yet hopeful futility of waiting for something that's never going to arrive. And also a kind of perhaps a sort of mordant reflection on the glories of that town's sort of industrial past. I might have said something terrible like that. But please,
that's
help me out. Help me out.
Fine, yeah. No, that would do, yeah. That would do great. I mean, yeah. But, I mean, basically what you said, really, John. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, the other thing that I kind of thought about was that there's that idea, if you're train spotting, you know, the train spotters who collect all these engine numbers, and there's inherent futility of that, because there's no way that you can collect every engine number in the old British rail system, and even less so apparently since privatisation, you can't do it. So it's a bit like kind of trying to, you know, the militant train spotters, apparently they go out and they hack into the British Rail computer system and all that kind of stuff to find all these engine numbers. But you're still never going to see the whole lot or collect the whole lot or kind of record the whole lot. So there's a kind of futility kind of built into it. And it's a bit like kind of being a junkie in a way. You know, you're kind of the mathematics of it, you know, mean that the kind of inverse mathematics of it mean that you're never going to get to this kind of point of satiation and harmony, and it's always going to be pulling further away from you, almost like a kind of train going out the station. And it just seemed to work for me. It just seemed to kind of work in a kind of for all sorts of reasons, the reasons that you've suggested and the reasons that I've come out with there, but for a whole kind of cocktail of emotional reasons that just and symbolic kind of reasons that just seem to fit.
I seem to remember coming out of the film of it and my wife saying, "Why, that's great, why is it called Trainspotting?" Did that actually get into the film?
I think it's very difficult in a film because you're kind of... you're just trying to bang down a narrative and distill it and to capture the spirit of the book. So to try and get to these kind of nuances is very difficult. And that's the kind of glory of literature, really, that you can do that. You can put these kind of these layers and these kind of broader thematic concerns on something that you can't really do in the same way in a movie.
And what about, I mean, obviously the kind of striking thing about the book... Well, there's two striking things, I mean, about the book when you first read it, especially I think if you're an English as opposed to a Scottish reader. One, which I want to come to in a second, is the sort of language, the dialect. But the first, I suppose, is the structure of it and the fact that, you know, there are all these... Although there's one main... You could call him a protagonist, I guess. One central character who gets more of the narration than anybody else. There's also... There are quite a lot of other narrators. There are bits which are in... You know, most of it's in the first person, bits in the third person. And sometimes, so the story, which, as you say, in the film, you know, there has to be a kind of a real narrative thread. But in the book, quite a lot of what actually happens, you have to infer because it happens between the section. I mean, how did that kind of come about? Was that sort of part of the design of it?
I started off trying to write it in a kind of standard English, and it wasn't working. It wasn't kind of capturing the sort of the basic kind of funk and the rhythm of how people were speaking and how they were interacting. And I kind of thought about it as a bunch of, you know, when you get a bunch of guys in a pub and they're half pissed and. It's, you know, tying it into that kind of Celtic kind of oral storytelling tradition that it's not like somebody's up there and kind of holding court and everybody else is just sort of nodding away. I mean, everybody's shouting and sort of trying to get the tuppence worth in. And I thought I would try to, you know, it made sense to try and approximate that kind of structure where there was all these kind of voices constantly kind of bickering for attention. And one guy would eventually become the main voice, the main narrative voice, and it would be the kind of, the kind of person that wanted to tell the story most in a way. You know, I mean, the others would get caught off in the actual drama of being in the moment and doing the thing and kind of being in the scene, whereas there's one person in that kind of group who would be compelled to tell the story. So, and they would kind of. Their voice would emerge just through the sheer process of will, the sheer process of them wanting to tell the story, being bothered about telling the story, rather than just purely being an actor in it.
And did you let the decision about who you were going to have speak next just kind of come to you, or did you? If as a reader, let me give an example of when there was quite a sort of there seemed like quite an important decision, because there's this, everybody knows. There's this pretty terrifying character, Begbie, and I guess you're thinking, if you've read, like me, lots of bourgeois novels, you're kind of thinking in sort of George Eliot way, oh, well, I mean, actually, can he be as nasty as all that? Because, you know, the George Eliot way of thinking is that actually everybody's got their reasons and everybody's got their...
Sure.
And then you get to page whatever it is, I think it's something like 80, 90,
right.
And there's Begbie speaking to you, my God, he's worse! He's worse than it, you know, when he's actually, and he's speaking to you, the reader, he's got nothing to hide, nobody's overhearing him, so if he's showing off, he's showing off to you as a reader, he's not showing off in front of his mates in the pub. And that sort of, so that has quite a kind of major effect on what you think of him as a character. He seemed, you know, it makes him seem kind of, I suppose, pretty, I don't know, irredeemable, really.
Yeah, I mean, It's weird because, you know, one of the things that I'd said when we were chatting about this earlier is that I probably wouldn't have done this before. I wouldn't have wanted to talk about Trainspotting. Basically because it's like once you write something, it's kind of gone from you, really. You're on to the next thing. You're not really thinking about kind of previous things you've written about. And also because it's like, you know, I feel there's been so much kind of talked about Trainspotting that I didn't really think that I had much to add to it. But recently I started, I found his old notes, and when I wrote Trainspotting, I had all these kind of notes of, you know, what I wanted to write, and all these kind of sketches and all these drafts of stories. And what I basically did was, you know, there was just loads and loads of stuff. And so what I did is I kind of basically chopped the middle of it, pulled it out, and tacked an ending onto it. So you basically saw them as hardcore junkies, and Begbie as this kind of violent guy and all that. And what I wanted to do, I've got the first section of it that's unpublished, and I wanted to, I've gone back and I've started to work with that and rewrite it, because I've taken an interest again in the characters, and because of that, I've got back into reading the novel, you know, reading Trainspotting, so it's kind of become interesting to me again, whereas it's been boring to me for so many years, you know, and now I've suddenly got quite interested in it again. So you basically caught me at the right time.
All right, good. Well, that's good. That's good. And just make me have his story.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's got his story about how he becomes the person he is, in a way, or not how he becomes, but you're given indications about what's happened to him, to, you know, what journey he's been on to make him that kind of person, what issues he's faced, and it's the same with all the guys that are doing heroin. It charts their kind of their kind of transition from being like just party animals and guys that like to go out, young guys going out having a good time, into hardcore junkies. And it's looking at what's kind of what's driving that sort of that kind of need in each of them, which is different in every one of them.
Because what you find out, I guess, what you find out with some of the narratives, particularly with Mark Renton, the main narrator, is actually, this is what I found. I don't know if it was so much in your mind, was that whatever he says in dialogue, his narration is, for a start, sometimes in a different kind of language, not always, but sometimes when he's thinking about certain things. And also it's full of kind of scruples and political analyses, and sometimes it makes it seem, you know, but then when he talks to his friends, you know, all that's not there anymore. That's kind of, so there's a kind of, it's almost like, it's particularly with Mark, it's like it's a sort of two languages, really. I don't mean, which is, I guess he uses at certain times when he has to.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's that kind of archetypal character from the, you know, the kind of the kind of educated working class guy who looks at his material surroundings and looks at the world, and he sees the impossibility. You know, he sees the impossibility of kind of like revolutionary social change, because he's kind of he's not kind of naive in that kind of way, but he also sees the kind of self-defeating thing about kind of social mobility and all that for its own sake, and the kind, you know, the moving into the bourgeoisie and the washing machines and stuff like that. So he sees that as kind of limiting as well. So there's always that kind of thing when somebody, you know, from a working class background, you know, there's always this kind of thing between, do you change society, do you try and change society, or do you look out for yourself and climb up the social ladder, basically. And he's gone through that kind of ultra cynical thing where neither of these things are either attainable or desirable to him. So there's this kind of sort of nihilistic sort of mentality that he's swamped by. And I mean, there's nothing better for that than junk, basically, because it stops him from. It basically kind of puts him in this place that, you know, apart from the mainstream society.
There's these odd little glimpses of sort of, you know, I was quite near the end of the book. I was rereading it quite near the end of the book. He suddenly makes some comment in his narrative about Derek Jarman, and you suddenly think, oh god, this guy on the quiet, you know, what does he do? He's reading articles in The Guardian or something, or going to art films.
Yeah,
or
he probably is. He's doing all that kind of stuff. He's reading articles in The Guardian. He's going to art shows. He's watching art house movies. He's reading novels, kind of, but it's a very guilty pleasure for him. He's reading philosophers and all that, but he's keeping it apart from this kind of life, because he kind of feels that this this is part of this process of von Bourgeoisment, which he's trying to resist, is actually within him already. You know, this is the kind of the tremendous tensions that he feels. I mean, it's like that kind of thing that trying to relate it to my own kind of experience about becoming a writer. I mean, the first writer that I really liked, that I really felt a tremendous bond with, was Evelyn Waugh. You know, I loved all Evelyn Waugh's books, and that was because my Uncle Jack, who was a fireman, was studying at the Open University, and he had all Evelyn Waugh's books, and he passed them on to my dad, and he passed them on to me, and I loved the stories, I loved the characters, and I loved the way the characters interacted, and I always wanted to kind of I wanted to kind of be able to write characters like that, but not upper class characters. And there was no, you know, and it took me a long way and a long literary journey really to find people that I could kind of almost gave me permission to become a writer. So I think that the whole point of somebody like Renton, and to some extent Sick Boy as well, is that you're kind of limited in your options by what's around you.
Yeah.
You know, you grow up in this kind of environment where you believe that certain things aren't intrinsically for you, so they become, there's also an element of guilt attached to them, you know, when you do enjoy them.
Yeah, because Sick Boy kind of knows about the drama of Bertolt Brecht, doesn't he, at one stage? I mentioned the dialect. I wondered, you know, I suppose one way of asking a question would be whether that was just naturally kind of part of the writing of it for you from the beginning, but I suppose a sort of more selfish question really would be, when you wrote it, I wondered if you had in mind what it would be like to be read by sort of non-Scottish readers, because when you read Trainspotting, I mean, it's true, after you've read for an hour or two and a go, you get, if you're not Scottish, you get quicker and quicker at it. But when you put it down for a day or two, or when you first come to it, you do actually have to kind of be in a room with nobody else and sort of start trying to say.
I don't think it, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I think it's a bit of a red herring, really. I don't think it really matters that quick, because even for Scottish people, for me, you know, it just looks strange, because the words look strange on a page. I mean, Scottish people aren't used to seeing words like that written on a page. It's a kind of visual thing, more. And I think it's like kind of once you start reading it, and if you read the first bits aloud and you get into the rhythms of it, then it works out okay. But I think it's a visual thing rather than a kind of linguistic thing.
So for a Scottish reader, it's just as much of a kind of challenge at first.
Yeah, I think they hear the voices, so they get into it quicker. But I mean, everybody's heard Scottish voices on TV and all and they can do. You might not be a great ventriloquist, but it's like everybody thinks they can do accents, and they're always embarrassing themselves and everybody else by going like, "I see you, Jimmy," or "All right, Governor," or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, and when I go to places like the USA or Canada and Australia, it's like the people there, that they really like the books, because I think they feel in this globalised kind of era, when everything's kind of sort of filtered down and sort of made over accessible, that they don't really have to fight for their culture. They don't really have to fight to get into things. You know, it's all spoon fed, and I think people kind of react against that. And I tend to get a very clued up kind of readership there, they kind of really get it on that level, you know. So,
and what do they think about? What do they think about the, as one of the elderly mums says late in the book, the language. About the language? Because they're quite sort of... I think American critics are often quite a lot more censorious about that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the Americans are really strange about that sort of thing. You know, they'll drop bombs, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And they'll shoot each other. But, you know, if you see, like, a fuck or a cunt or something like that in a story, it's a bit kind of... it's still a bit crazy, you know. So, I think that... because of the, you know, Not so much. I mean, it's much different in Australia, for example. They don't even notice in Australia. But in America, there's a kind of... for example, the word cunt in America is like, you just can't say it. I mean, even if... the most kind of hard-ass kind of sort of ghetto hip-hop guys just will be as offended as the kind of Long Island accountant. You know, if you say that word, it's just got a whole different set of connotations. And so I think there is a kind of weird thing there, and there is a weird sort of religious thing in America. I mean, I couldn't believe how I still kind of. It's weird, we in Europe think that that social and economic progress in a kind of economic kind of like post-industrial kind of powerhouse economy equals secularism, and that kind of thing dies out as you get. But it kind of seems to be stronger there than ever, you know.
There isn't religious cursing or blasphemy particularly in the book, is it? Is there? Because we had Edna O'Brien here once, and she was saying that, you know, when she wrote her first novel, somebody saying Jesus Christ in it was kind of really, high voltage, and how actually this was, you could see that this in a way was quite an advantage for a novelist because they could really generate a charge by it. But they're quite, they're not contemptuous of religion, any of the characters, are they?
I think that they don't even see it as part of the. You know, it's not even an option to. And like most people in Britain, I mean, I don't think
it's
that,
just a football. It's a football.
One of the most beautiful things about Britain is that we don't give a toss about religion. And it's only now that Tony Blair feels comfortable about kind of coming out as this kind of sort of kind of mad sort of Christian. You know, it's like kind of whereas. Somebody like Bush could just do it right from the start, you know. Whereas he at least knew when he was in office that people would just rip the fucking piss out of him if he started all that crap. Like, you know, they think he's a nutter, you know. And they are the fucking nutters, every one of them. Okay?
we'll have some blogs, I expect. That's what blogs are for. Just on that, because I'm afraid. So swearing novels is a kind of pet interest of mine. Just because, as I said, you know, there was a long, long time when it wasn't possible, and then it suddenly happened. And I don't know what do you think of the? He wasn't around to read Trainspotting, but what do you think of the sort of Kingsley Amis line? Because he wrote this article partly in response to the fact that Martin Amis. In Success, I think it was in Success, had written a chapter of it in which it seemed like his sole aim was to use the word fuck as many times as possible in a single chapter. I mean, his dad wrote this essay saying, oh, it's such a pity because in the good old days, if you said bloody, you could really get something out of it. But now we've lost, you know, sadly... Everybody's tolerance has meant that it's sort of it's not a resource for novelists anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that it depends on the context you're using it in. It's like kind of, it's a bit like I mean Martin Amis used the fucks in Success. It's a bit like Hugh Grant in Four Weddings and a Funeral when he goes fuck, 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 fuck. You basically don't believe Toff swearing. It never really works to the same extent, you know. But without kind of coming across all kind of like James Kelman-esque here and saying that, you know, and running out and, you know, saying that you're all bourgeois cunts and stuff. But it's like, I think that, you know, it's not necessarily swearing. I mean, it's like kind of, it's again, it's the context that it's used in, you know. It's like kind of, I had a fucking cunt of a time last night. Brilliant, you know. That's not swearing to me. That's just a kind of, language is a living thing that's used in all different ways in all different cultures, and I think you have to accept it.
Well, your characters use the word cunt affectionately or respectfully. Yeah, I mean, it's got every kind of intonation. The man who dies, they say, oh, he was a lovely
cunt.
He's a
great cunt. Yeah. but it's true. It's just, I mean, it's like, you know, for whatever reasons, it's the way that language has developed. I mean, it's like, I mean, the I was writing this this novella that I had in the last book I had out called The Kingdom of Fife, and it was like it was set in Fife, and everybody says Yahoo, and everybody's called Yahoo, and everybody's called Sir as well. You know, it's like if when you go over to Fife, if you're buying a newspaper and the woman's serving, you go, "Thanks, sir." You know, "Thanks, sir." And there's all got the different roots. I mean, it's like the "sir" thing comes from when the Fife miners were forced to address the managers as "sir." So to circumvent this, and they get fired and they get their money, their wages docked if they didn't call the management in of the mines "sir." So they called everybody "sir." They called their wife "sir," and their wife started calling their children "sir" and all that, you know. And it was like, the "whore" thing was like was women in Fife who just started calling everybody, you know, because guys were calling women "whores," so they started calling everybody "whore." So now it's like, "How you doing, yeah, whore, sir?" So everybody it's just spread around. So everybody's either called "sir" or "whore." Or usually both, like, "How's it going, yeah, whore, sir? How you doing?" So I mean, all these things, they've all got these different kind of social roots, and it's like, you know, for whatever reason, and it's easy to say, "Oh, people have just got a limited vocabulary, blah, blah, blah," but maybe they have, and maybe they've got limited exposure to educational opportunities. Maybe that's something that we should be doing about it as a society, but I know that these terms that, you know, that are seen as kind of pejorative in some cultures are used in all different ways. So
I mean, the amount of swearing that goes on in all the conversations is simply, that's how people talk. It's not a...
Well, I think there's a difference between, he was a great cunt at a funeral, and that cunt's fucking dead. You know, it's like it's a whole different way of, you know. So I think you can say one is swearing, one is cursing, the other one is a form of affection. It's the same word. It's like kind of, and you know, the words just become different as time goes by. You know?
I was thinking of the man who reacts to the news of the death of a friend by saying, "Oh, he's a lovely cunt." Reminds me of the fact that. So I wanted to ask about the deaths in a novel, which is otherwise it's quite a funny novel, but it's sort of there are a lot of them.
Yeah, I think the death thing was directly influenced by the kind of what was going on in Edinburgh at the time, because on the personal level, when I was getting into heroin, everybody that I knew and grew up with in the housing scheme was saying to me, like, you're an idiot, this is crazy and all that, and it's like. When I came back, when I came back up, it was like all these people who were saying it was crazy, they were kind of, they were banging up smack, left, right and centre, and often for not very long, just for maybe, a couple of weeks or even a one-off, and because of the massive HIV thing that was at Edinburgh in the 80s, there was literally, in the scheme that I grew up, people were just dropping like flies, you know, so they were getting sick and nobody really knew. I mean, it was like, this was back in the time when AIDS was kind of sort of touted as a gay man's disease rather than anything to do with intravenous drug use. So people were very innocent about what they were doing. And you had all this, you suddenly had in a place like Muirhouse where I grew up, you had like mass unemployment, and then you had the whole place being flooded with smack, with cheap Pakistani heroin. It was, you know, just like kind of, it's always a conspiracy theorist's kind of sort of wet dream, really, but these two things happened at the same time, like heroin replaced jobs, but replaced employment opportunities and educational opportunities, and you had the needle exchange in Bread Street in Edinburgh shut down as well. The police raided the needle exchange and shut it down. So you had all this kind of use of big kind of syringes and people sharing and passing them around, and just blood-to-blood intravenous infection without anybody realising what was going on. Yeah. So, I kind of lost count of the number of funerals I attended in the 80s, and it's a kind of weird thing to do, you know, when you're kind of, when you're in your 20s, You always associate like attending lots of funerals of your peers as something that you do, kind of you know, maybe in your 60s, 70s and all that, if you're, you know, if, you know, if you're unfortunate in your 50s and 40s, but in your 20s to attend that many funerals, I think, had a massive impact on me and a big impact on the book. Yeah.
There's three funerals in the book, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, it's, anyway, we must, I must abandon my privilege for, and just ask, and who, if there's anybody here who'd like to ask Evan a question. I'm really sorry, we've got a microphone which will... You won't hear any difference in your voice when you hold this, but it helps us do the podcast, so I'm sorry about this.
I was interested in the section Bad Blood and where it originated from. I remember reading it myself, getting to a certain point and being so horrified I threw it across the lounge, waited for about 5-10 minutes, and then got the courage to pick it up again and continued to find out it wasn't quite as bad as it seemed. Just wondered where you, where that idea originated from.
It's actually been, it was actually made into a short film by this Canadian bunch of people, and I don't know, Alan Cumming, who was just kind of Scottish actor, like kind of, he was he played the lead role in it. He did a really good job. I mean, obviously it's a short film, so it's not been kind of widely seen, but I thought it was a very good. It was all set in Canada. They Canadianised it, but I thought, even though Alan Cumming's Scottish, like, you know, so it was weird, but I thought it was very good. I mean, it was like, I don't know where I got, I mean, I just thought about what's the worst possible thing you could do to mess this guy's head up, you know, to hurt this guy, and I think that's where it came from, you know. It's always, I think any writer will tell you, you know, you're always asking kind of what if questions, you know, and, I think probably at that time I was kind of like, you know, I was in the mindset where I was asking, you know, what's the worst possible thing that could happen here, you know? So.
I wonder if you could tell me just where were you at when you actually wrote the book? You know, where did some of these ideas come from?
Basically, it was like Acid House, really. I mean, that kind of, when that kicked off, that was a big sort of thing to me, because I was like kind of... once I'd come through that kind of heroin period of the kind of early 80s, like 82, 83, I was very kind of, I was just Mr. Straight, basically. I was like this nice kind of sort of career guy who'd kind of got married and got a couple of promotions at work, and was, I had no interest in sort of, you know, sort of going out and having a, you know, sort of, I mean, I went out at the weekends and all that and had a drink and went to the football and all that, but, I kind of thought that this was basically me, you know, and this was my kind of life. And then going out and getting into Acid House and going out raving and clubbing and, you know, sort of meeting people in that kind of scene, that I kind of got in touch with this guy, Kevin Williamson, who I'd kind of known for a while, just as this guy who played pool in the Fiddler's Arms and in Edinburgh. And I found out that he was doing this literary magazine, and, you know, he had all this, you know, he had all these ideas about kind of sort of starting up this club and all that. So and, you know, having readings at the club. So we started to do that, and had this club called Invisible Insurrection, and it was like a kind of, it's almost like a kind of post-chill type of thing, you know. It didn't really work. It didn't, you know, the idea was that people would get off the face and have a good time, and then they come back and listen to these poets, but in practice they just wanted to get off the face more. It was putting on, you know, seeing everybody doing all these poems and stuff like that, I kind of thought, well, I could do this. I've got written a lot of stuff in these old diaries, and I went back to that, and I had the good fortune to be at Edinburgh at the same time as people like Duncan MacLean, who was Robin had published, and he had the Clock Tower Press, and he was a friend of Kevin Williamson's as well, and there was lots of people. Like Alan Warner was living in Edinburgh at the time, and he was writing Morven Collar, and Barry Graham, who was being published by Bloomsbury, and he was putting on readings all over the city, and there's people like Paul Reakey and Rodney Relax and Gordon Legg, who'd been published by Polygon, and there was just all these people kind of roughly doing the same thing, but nobody ever kind of really knew about it. And with Duncan doing Clock Tower and Kevin doing Rebel Inc, it kind of pulled everybody in to this kind of one place. I didn't really think much about it at the time, but now that I think about it, I mean, Edinburgh is quite a small city for all this thing to be going on, and I think I was fortunate that I was kind of part of that that thing, and it kind of energized me, and it gave me a lot of confidence. You know, when you see people that are around you that are doing all this kind of stuff, it makes you want to get up there and do it as well. You know, and it kind of it's the difference between stuff lying in a sort of a drawer in your kind of house, and you getting up and sort of reading it out to people, and or having the confidence to sort of to get it publishable and send it off to a publisher. You know, so I think that was really kind of important.
Okay, you mentioned that James Kelman was one of your influences. What were your other influences, and what was the best book that you've read recently?
I don't know if I did mention Jim as an influence, like, you know, I think that was what you said, like, but he is anyway, like, you know, so fair enough, like, you know. This is a podcast, so you can see this actually, so I better watch what I say about him. But I talked about sort of, I mean, my journey was like kind of Evelyn Waugh, and then sort of getting into, you know, like English literature from basically kind of, you know, like kind of, you know, all the classic stuff, like kind of Jane Austen, Emily Bronte, and kind of from then on in, I kind of, I was trying to find my own, because I was trying to find a kind of voice, I went into like Black American writers, from all the Black Panther stuff, like kind of Bobby Seale and Elridge Cleaver and all that, and I kind of detoured into like Iceberg Slim, and then I started to read all these American novels, like kind of Faulkner and all that kind of stuff, and then I kind of went into all the European stuff, like Kafka, and then like, you know, Russian writers like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and all that. They were kind of sort of it took me a while to kind of get back to Scotland, and I didn't really, you know, and then I found out about William McIlvany, and then Kelman, and then Alistair Gray, and so, you know, that was my kind of literary journey, really.
I think the question I wanted was a recommendation on the recent.
Yeah, the one of the best books I've read recently was it's a book called The Jewish Messiah by a guy called Aaron Grunberg. Has anybody heard of this? No, read it. What it's about is it's basically about this guy from Switzerland whose grandfather was. An SS officer who sent all the Jews to the extermination camps. So he decides that he's going to comfort the Jewish nation. And he falls in love with this Jewish guy who's a rabbi's son. And he decides to become Jewish, and he has this circumcision that's botched, and he has to get one of his testicles amputated. And his testicle he carries around with him in the jar. And his testicle becomes called King David. And he takes King David around with him, and eventually he has this project. He tries to translate Mein Kampf into Yiddish and Hebrew, and they get a publisher to do this. And eventually, all sorts of machinations, he becomes the Prime Minister of Israel. They go to Israel and becomes the Israeli Prime Minister, and he kind of decides to try and make a common cause with the Palestinians, and they attack Spain for some reason. I don't know why. the way they declare war on Spain, you know. So it's a fantastic book. It's
quite a lot happens.
Loads happen. Like, you know. So I'd recommend it. It's Aaron Grunberg, a kind of New York-based Amsterdam native who's written this book called The Jewish Messiah.
Thanks very much to Irving Welsh for coming and talking to us about Trainspotting, and thank you very much to our audience here tonight.